Good morning. My name is Lindsay Shaughnessy. I am a senior international relations major here at Carleton. Today's speaker is Justice Paul Anderson, an associate justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court since he was appointed in 1994. In 1965, Justice Anderson graduated with honors from McAllister College and received his law degree from the U of M in 1968. He spent some time working as an attorney for Vista, as well as in the office of the Minnesota Attorney General, and for nearly 20 years at a private practice in St. Paul. In 1992, Justice Anderson was appointed Chief Judge to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. His professional and civil activities have been and continue to be diverse, ranging from his professorship at the U of M Law School to his protection of multicultural diversity through his seat on the Implementation Committee on Multicultural Diversity and Racial Fairness in the Courts. Justice Anderson has been recognized as a strong community member through his roles as a girls' basketball coach, a cross-country cyclist, a school board chairman, and board member to several important boards, such as the South St. Paul Chamber of Commerce. Justice Anderson believes strongly in the nonpartisan court and has worked toward achieving racial fairness and diversity in the courtroom. I had a chance to speak with him just now and asked him what he was, aside from his resume, and he's a Renaissance man. He's a gourmet cook, a cyclist, and he has deep Minnesota roots and is really happy to be here today. His convocation presentation will focus on the freedoms that have permitted our nation to flourish, as well as the judiciary's role in protecting these freedoms. Thank you for your attention. Please join me in welcoming Justice Paul Anderson to Carleton College today.
Well, I am legitimately very pleased to be here. I have a small liberal arts college background. You notice that I was at McAllister, and I do pay rapt attention to the national rankings between Mac and Carleton. And when I was Mac, we were always secondhand rows. Is that Carleton was just always there. But Mac has become a little bit of a national boutique school lately and say, hey, they're not doing so bad. And so, but I am a big fan of the small liberal arts college education. I am forever grateful for the different experiences that McAllister gave me. Now, I'm going to speak for a while here, and at the end I'm going to ask questions. Now, one of the things I do is that I get out and I'm in schools a lot. I'm in a school someplace in the state or talking to a school group at least once a week while school's in session. Middle schools, fifth, sixth graders, high school, law students, adults, colleges. Well, I say, and the thing is that I get different questions from each audience. I mean, I love the questions from the fifth and sixth graders. They're just so... they'll ask anything, and they're so sweet in their questions, and they'll just—they'll ask anything about their curiosity. You can see how their mind works, and you get a bit of that the same from high school and middle school. Law students, they start getting a little deferential. You can tell it in their questions. You know, they're thinking about law school. This is a Supreme Court justice. You know, they pass on fitness and ethics, so maybe I better not. So they're a little too deferential. Adults are pretty good, but also deferential. Your age group is the most fun and also the most challenging because you are so skeptical. You do not take anything I say at face value. In fact, you think that, well, most likely what he's going to say doesn't have any face value. And I'm going to challenge it, and I expect that from you, and so ask tough questions. But when we start out, I want you to understand, what our respective tasks are, okay? Because it's going to be a whole lot easier if we understand what the rules are and what the tasks are, okay? I'm going to quote Adlai Stevenson here. My job is to talk to you for a while. Your task, your job, is to listen to me for a while. And I really sincerely hope we finish our tasks at about the same time. And there's a real danger if you don't. And it will allow some questions. The other thing is that I know what the challenge is like to speak at convocation. Now, when I was at Mac, is that convocation was mandatory. And I had occasion last weekend to spend some time with about a dozen former classmates from McAllister. So I was talking about, now, what do you remember from convocation? What do you remember the speakers? And I mentioned some of the speakers. I mean, these were my classmates. They went to the same, well, I don't remember him. I don't remember her, mostly him. And finally, I mentioned, well, do you remember when Billy Graham came? Oh, yeah. And so what do you remember about Billy Graham? Well, I remember his alligator shoes. I didn't remember anything about what Billy Graham said, but I remember these really classy alligator shoes. So two things went through my mind. I regretted that I didn't follow my wife's advice and buy a new pair of shoes 2 months ago when she told me, but I did shine them today, so just in case anybody's looking. I'm going to talk to you about something today that I consider very important, and it should be very important to you, and it's freedom. And sometimes we don't think about that enough, and we don't give it enough consideration. And I'm going to talk to you about the role of the judiciary in preserving freedom in this country of ours. And I apologize, it's going to be a little bit of a civics lesson. I'm going to give you a bit of history. I'm going to talk to you about some dead white guys who I think played a major role in making our country what it was. But I'm going to focus on what I consider and what has been identified as America's legacy, and the main thing that we've given to this world, in this democratic world that we're talking about, and it's the United States Constitution, and what that document means and what it has brought to us and to the world. Now, I wanted to come up with a catchy title and something to describe you know, what my topic is about, and being of my generation, I remember Janis Joplin and the song Me and Bobby McGee. Actually, that song was written by Fred Foster and Kris Kristofferson, and actually the original Bobby McGee was generally conceded to be female, and she was a worker on the floor right below where Fred Foster was, and he came up one day and he kept repeating the name Bobby McGee, and and he was kind of enamored with her. One thing led to another, and they wrote this song. Question is they aren't sure who recorded it first, whether it was Gordon Lightfoot or Roger Miller. Roger Miller hit the charts fairly big with it, 13 on the total charts and number one on the country charts. But it's Janis Joplin who really made that song. And it's only one of two songs, I think, that posthumously was a number one song. But there's a line on that song is that basically says, I'm not going to get the lyrics quite right, is it? But freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose, and nothing is nothing but it's free. And my comment on those words, and I take that and twist, is that they got it wrong in those lyrics. Freedom is everything to lose, and freedom isn't free. Freedom comes at a real big price. Now, I'm a little worried, you know, is that when I come up with a catchy title like that, is it what people will do with it? And I got some experience, and I wrote an article on civics education for the Minnesota School Boards Journal, and I wanted to get a catchy opening line, and so I started out, civics education is malnourished, and we need to restore it to health. And submitted the article, they liked it, and then the article came out. And I was just appalled and crushed because somebody thought they were being real clever. They put a picture on that page with an emaciated young lady. What they didn't understand, I had a daughter who suffered from mental health. And this was a picture of a young lady who was suffering anorexia. And I'm just absolutely appalled that they would do that with my girl. They thought they were being clever. They were tying it into my opening line. And so I'm a little worried when I do Janis Joplin, is that knowing about her drug abuse and whatever, is that I use this thing, is that, okay, they're going to tie me somehow away. So it's a little bit of a chance. But anyway, with that said, I'm now going to talk to you about liberty and the role of the courts. And the roles of the courts in protecting liberty. And you may think that, well, this isn't all that current. It's not something that's really on the agenda. How many of here listened to the debate last night? Raise your hand. Okay, I did too. Okay. And is it one of the questions was asked of both of the vice presidential candidates, is there something in your life that has changed? Have you changed your view on something? Have you changed your perspective? And I thought Senator Biden's answer was interesting. He said, yes, he said, when I came to the Senate, is that when we were appointing judges, were advising and consenting for judges, I thought that good academic record, good background, good moral, ethical conduct was all that was necessary. He said, I've changed my mind. He said, more and more as time's going on, is that I have come to the conclusion that actually the ideology of a judge who was appointed to a high judicial position is relevant and important. Now, when I ask the question, I've been a Supreme Court justice for 14 years, and I ask the question, is that, have you changed? Have you modified your outlook at all since you've been on the court? And I would say, yes. I have become much more enamored with that marvelous document, which is the Constitution of the United States. And I'm more enamored with the magnificence of that document and the wisdom that somehow got into that document at the time that our founders drafted that document. And I mean the insight that they had. And here's a little bit of a history lesson. You know, and it's so typical about times, is that when the Revolutionary War was fought, it roughly broke down like this. About a third of the population wanted to separate from England. About a third wanted to stay with England, and about a third didn't care. I mean, that's the way life is. Now, history will be written as this, you know, it's like the whole population of the United States or the colonies at that time wanted to separate. No, that's not the way it was. And it was a very bloody and nasty conflict, and if particularly I thought the movie The Patriot captured that is that some of the bloodiest conflict happened in the South, in South Carolina, in the Carolinas, and it was internecine war, brother against brother and neighbor against neighbor. But the thing was, somewhat to the surprise of the colonists, they won. George III is packing up and going away. What do we do now? What do we do now? I mean, and it was a dilemma. I mean, it may surprise you. One of the biggest patriots of that time, John Adams, was very amenable to the idea that George Washington would be king. I mean, think about that. I mean, they were willing to have George Washington as king. I could illustrate when I talk to students, is that if I could find Lindsay, I'd ask her to come up here and I'd ask her name and I'd put her on the stage and I'd say, what's your name? And I'd say, Your Royal Highness, Queen Lindsay. And then I'd ask all of you in this room, are you comfortable with Lindsay being your queen, having all power and authority over you, could make you a lord or lady of the realm or could send you to the tower? How many would be comfortable with Lindsay as your queen? I mean, raise your hand. How many would have some problems with that? Raise your hand. Okay. Does somebody want to tell me what your problem would be with Lindsay as queen having all power? Somebody want to volunteer that? Somebody, why? Yeah, you're should speak up. What reservations would you have with Lindsay having all power? Somebody tell me. Yes, sir. You think that power might corrupt? It might corrupt, absolutely. I mean, you're human. But the thing is that the time of the revolution is it was so ingrained that you needed a king. You needed an all-powerful king. And in fact, if I had Lindsay up here, and she would probably, you know, was it she had a hereditary line of kings and queens, and she probably even appointed the archbishop, and the archbishop would say that, well, you know, Lindsay's family line is blessed by God with greater wisdom, and that's why she has to be king. I mean, maybe you start believing that. Well, is that the colonists were separating from that idea, and they were basing their new country on certain fundamental principles. It's called self-evident truths. All men, I added women, but that really didn't happen until the second decade of the 20th century. You got there, and if you're a person of color, probably didn't get there until 1965 with the Voting Rights Act. But they're created equal, and there are certain unalienable rights: life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, property, that's what John Locke said, self-determination, govern with the consent of those who govern, and he wanted a civil society. And this is so key, is a civil society governed by the rule of law, not the rule of men. It goes back to your statement, is that, sir, would you come down here? Why don't you come down? I want to ask you a question, okay? Is it, you know, from the introduction you had, you do know that I am a justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court, right? Actually, is that, you know, we're just celebrating our 150th year. And in all that time, I'm only the 76th person appointed to the Supreme Court. You know, that's a really small group. I got to be really good, right? Nah, good doesn't really describe it, does it? I got to be really better than good. Let's take a term from debate: superior. That doesn't actually describe it either, does it? You know, I got to be darn near perfect. I'm perfect, aren't I? Now to be careful here, because I saw you smiling and stifling a laugh when I said I was perfect. Okay, but somebody in the back says the truth. So am I perfect?
No.
Now let me ask you another question. Okay, I just want to follow up. I mean, do you think? Understand this: that I am on the Supreme Court, Court of Last Resort. You're telling me that if I'm not perfect, does that mean I make mistakes?
Yes.
You know. This is a chance. This is a teachable moment for all of you, okay? I'm going to tell you about the rule of holes. Do you know what the rule of holes is? It says, once you dug yourself in a hole, stop digging. You know? You know, you're just keep digging. What's your name, sir?
Ray.
Ray?
What? Ray.
Okay. Okay. One more chance, okay? I'm not perfect. I make mistakes. I'm fallible. Why do you say that?
I would be impressed. I would not believe it if you were perfect.
And why is that? He really didn't get the rule of holes, did he? He really didn't. You know, the thing is that you're absolutely right. Nobody's perfect. But I got to ask you a question, okay? You do know that I'm a Supreme Court justice, right? And I have a certain amount of sovereign power to make and enforce the laws. And you laughed at me. You did. And you also told me that I make mistakes, I'm fallible, and nobody's perfect. Did you have any fear that I would put you in jail, take repercussions against you or your family? Now, I sometimes struggle to come up with an exact definition of freedom. And that's why I did this exercise. So I can't come up with a better definition of freedom. Is that I call Ray down here and I challenge him, and it's kind of tough, and is that I put him on the spot, but he has the feeling that he can speak up and say the truth. And it's like the story of the emperor has no clothes. Do you remember that story of the kid? Everybody kind of acquiesces and whatever, and then this child says, the emperor has no clothes. This is basically what you did, Ray, was to say, Justice Anderson, that my story doesn't ring. And I said, and he did it without any fear of repercussions or any action being taken against him. So thank you, sir. Let me.
I mean, you know, I have to do this behind me. You know,
it does not get any better than that. And see, as I just, in May, I did a lecture tour of China. And I'm going to tell you, it's not that way in China. Is that I have good friends who are Chinese. They come here and they tell me that when they go back to China, it takes them 10 days, a week to 10 days to adjust their mentality as to how much they can say, where they can say it, even down to the extent that who they smile at and who they exchange glances with. You see, that's not freedom. But what you have here is freedom. And I'm just going to give a little bit of an example about what happened here and why freedom is so important. And I'm going to quote from William Allen White. And he says this, "You can have neither wise laws nor free enforcement of wise laws unless there is freedom of expression of the wisdom of the people, and alas, their folly with it. But if there is freedom, folly will die of its own poison, and wisdom will survive." See the demonstration that you had here? I came up with a premise that was so fallacious and full of folly. But if none of you spoke up, some of you might have left this room thinking, well, maybe he is pretty good. Maybe he is infallible. After all, he is the Supreme Court Justice. And so some of you have been skeptical, some of you might have left it, and it's repeated enough to get more and more to believe. But Ray spoke up, and you literally saw the folly of my statement wither and die in front of you. That's what freedom is about, folks. That's what it's about, and that's what makes this country so great, is because we have that ability to speak up and expose folly. I was watching some English historians talking about America and what makes it great. And they were saying is that, you know, the thing that makes America great is not only its freedom, but because of its freedom, it has the ability to periodically reinvent itself to meet the challenges of a changing world. I went to China, and this is a fascinating tour. In 10 days, I lectured at 5 of the 10 top law schools. I lectured at a police academy, a judge's training school, an undergraduate university. I had 16 meetings with justices of the Supreme Court, academics, law deans, across the board. And I tell you, I was impressed with that country. I mean, the building there is tremendous. I think the national bird must be the construction crane. And as if you're wondering about gas shortage or cement shortage, it's all going over there. And I think the store is Marc Jacobs. You know, can you find a Marc Jacobs store in the Twin Cities? There's 16 Marc Jacobs stores in China. I think a couple in Beijing. And downtown they have all these boutiques with a lot of money, a lot of dynamic things going on. But I tell you is that I came away being aware of the threat that we have and the challenge that we have from China, but also, Mary Ware, is what is our advantage? And our advantage is that many of the students I talked to, they tended to think in silos. Their ability to think outside of the envelope is limited because of the autocratic, oppressive nature of that country. Now, there are a lot of people who want more freedom, and they do want the rule of law in the area of commerce, but they're struggling because they don't have, they're worried in some ways even about the nature of the Chinese people. They don't have what we have, which is the thing that's so most important, is that this template of over two centuries of freedom. And what has been the guarantor of that freedom? And this goes back to the American legacy that talk about it's our Constitution. Yep. I got to keep my watch here so I don't go too long. I want to talk to you a little bit about what that Constitution is. And if you want to understand the Constitution, I'm going to speak in legal terms. It's basically a contract. In its simplest terms, it's a contract. I told you that the country is being formed and it was being based on certain principles. And so what they decided, looking at what John Locke, I mean, is it 1689, they threw out James II, they brought in William and Mary, and as they had a semblance of a parliament, a semblance of a somewhat separate judiciary, and John Locke talked about this social contract. And into this idea of one of the fans of Locke was Montesquieu, who talked about this separation of powers, you divide the powers. You get a little bit of Rousseau in there. You maybe get a little bit of Hobbes, although, I mean, I think Hobbes was helpful because Hobbes believed that the natural state of man was to be at each other's throats. And so the founders knew that, hey, we got to design a system here, is that we can't let ourselves degenerate and deteriorate into our natural state because our natural state is to be at war with each other. So we need some type of construct and structure, and that's where they came up with the contract. Every one of you in this room who is a citizen of the United States is a party to that contract. And it's a contract that you make with those you put in positions of sovereign power. And sovereign power basically is that you give the power of someone to make and enforce the laws. But the most important thing that you need to remember about that contract, though, it is a limited contract. Do you know what a limited contract is? You don't give up everything. You reserve a lot to yourself. And that's what we need to understand is that you limit those who you give sovereign power to. There are limits on their powers. Now, history will tell us that people will exceed those powers, and we need some checks and balances. And our founders, picking up on Montesquieu, really figured out is that, you know, we know that someone like Justice Anderson is fallible, is that he will make mistakes. So we don't want to concentrate too much power in him, so we're going to divide it between the executive, legislative, and judicial. And the thing is that in this 3,000-plus word document, is that, as I look at that document, and I almost deal with it every day, it doesn't tell me how to deal with wiretapping specifically. It doesn't tell me how to deal with the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. It doesn't tell me about the internet or pornography on the internet, how you deal with that. It doesn't tell me how to do exactly with police searches, but it sets out the general principles. And the thing is that, you know, the founders initially thought that it was evident on the face of this document that it is a limited contract. But some of the founders said, well, I'm not so sure subsequent generations would get it. They might have been thinking about Scalia, I'm not sure. But anyway, as Justice Scalia on the Supreme Court, is that they may not get it to the extent that this contract is limited. And so in 1791, they put in the Bill of Rights. And that's where the Fourth Amendment, the First Amendment, the Fifth Amendment are put in. And so they said, we're going to make it explicit that this is a limited contract and we limit these rights. But they also divided power. And I want to give you an example of how that works. Do we have any basketball players in the audience? Raise your hand if you're a basketball player. Come on, please. I need just two volunteers. You got to have some. Okay, come on up. You're a basketball player. Somebody else. Is that another basketball player? Is that... If not, okay, in the back. Come on down here. Come on. What I'm going to do is give you a little bit of an example. You got to get up on stage. Of how this whole system of separation of powers works. And is that, you know, it's very frustrating when you see Congress in session. You think, oh, they don't get along. The president doesn't get along with Congress, whatever. And so I want you to visualize you've got to get over on this side. Because you need to visualize exactly the way this thing works. You see the gentleman down there in the blue shirt? He's going to shoot the basket, okay? The basket is right above us. And we know that he only is going to make about one out of three shots. So there's likely two out of three there's going to be a
rebound, okay? You want the rebound, you want the rebound, I want the rebound. Envision a sign on this young lady that says legislature, legislator. Sign over here says executive. Sign on me says judicial. Okay, what are you going to do to block out in order to get that rebound? Come on, don't worry about it. Do what you do. Do what you do. Okay. Can you push? Okay, now, when I push over here, you come on, keep pushing. Oh, look at the legislative pushing against. You know, that's exactly what happened this week. The president, the executive over here, is that I just happen to be the middle. Now, you're good in the middle. Now, let's block out here, okay? And see, now what's happening, the legislative and the executive are bumping up against each other. The executive wanted to solve the financial crisis this way. The legislative says, no, this way. I have no idea how it's going to, you know, you might be throwing some rough elbows today. Is it that that's the way it's designed to be? Now, some of you get all in it off and get frustrated with this. Let's do it again here, okay? Yeah, you know, this jousting back and forth, okay? Now, you must be following President Bush. He does that to the executives, or the judicial something. He's got, well, you know, we're going to push back on the Guantanamo cases. Okay, Mr. Bush, you can't do that. Okay? Is that, so when you think about how government works, I mean, don't look at my shoes. They're not alligator shoes. But if you remember anything about this presentation, remember what you have here, this blocking out. Understand that the system is designed to divide power, to protect your freedom, to protect your liberties. And to do that, sometimes it's not very efficient, and sometimes it gets a little messy. You get a few elbows thrown. Okay, let's do it again. Now, I'm going to ask you to throw an elbow to my throat, okay? Yeah, right up to the throat, not hard. Okay, now I've had some people when they do that say, no foul, no blood, no foul, okay? Well, do it again. You know, that hurts, okay? Sometimes some of the other branches follow. And I want you to understand what the judiciary does. And under the system that we have, is we call the fouls. It was developed under our system, particularly under the fourth Chief Justice, John Marshall, is that the judiciary calls the fouls. And what I mean really is that we interpret the contract. And we will say, throw that elbow again, okay? If we have the legislature going too far, is that they do something under the Patriot Act that infringes upon those rights that you reserve for yourself, it is our obligation to say, that's a foul. Don't do that. And is it in our system of government, we have the ability to do that. So thank you both for demonstrating how to think. Give them a round of applause. Now, what you need to know and understand about our system, the power between the executive and the legislative here, it will ebb and flow. Sometimes the legislator will be more powerful, sometimes the executive. In the 1950s, the legislative under Lyndon Johnson as majority leader and Sam Rayburn as Speaker of the House was more powerful. You had a strong but somewhat benign president in Dwight Eisenhower. He didn't exercise his powers. He saw it in a limited sense. You had a Supreme Court under the Chief Justice at that time, Earl Warren, was very expansive, very aggressive in the area of civil rights, but very narrow in the idea of the Commerce Clause. And so it ebbs and flows over the period of time. We are now in a period of time in our history where you have a very aggressive executive. This is not by accident. The Vice President, again, question last night, and this is how relevant the topic is how do you see the role of the Vice President and the powers of the Vice President? And it really was, I think Biden got the question, I'm not sure how well Sarah Palin did, is that how do you see the executive powers? Okay? And is it, see, Dick Cheney was in the White House, an aide to Nixon in the 1970s, when Nixon was impeached and resigned. And Dick Cheney has thought that ever since the 1970s, the powers of the executive in this country have been unduly limited.
I will not tell you whether Dick Cheney is right or wrong, but I will tell you that is a point of view with respect to the balance of power, and is that that's why, in fact, in the past recent years, we've had an expansion of executive power, and quite frankly, there have been a few elbows thrown in the direction of the judiciary and in the direction of the legislative. Now, the judiciary is pushed back, though. You have the cases out of Guantanamo, the writ of habeas corpus, where there was an attempt to deny access to the courts, access to attorney. And the court says, no, Mr. President, you can't do that. The most recent decision came out this summer. The president was in Italy, and they asked him, I said, what do you think about the recent Supreme Court ruling? Well, he kind of groused about it, but he's going to follow it, because that's the way the system is. And so, but it then, you need to understand again how important it is who the judges are and who's on the Supreme Court, because they get to call the fouls. They interpret the contract. And let me tell you, history tells us that there's a lot at stake. Lincoln, I always have a hard time in my own mind trying to see who's the best president, Lincoln or Washington. I always debate between the two. But anyway, Lincoln suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War. Now, he did get the permission of Congress, but he suspended habeas corpus. Is that Woodrow Wilson during the First World War? Is that Alfred E. Smith, the presidential candidate in 1928, said, during World War I, we wrapped the Constitution in a piece of paper and put it on a shelf, and we didn't bring it down until after the war was over. But let's talk about that great civil libertarian, the defender of the small person and individual rights, Franklin D. Roosevelt. We're in the depths of the Depression. And by the way, is that when you talk about leadership, you should understand, historical figures, I see some people are old enough, they probably remember Adlai Stevenson, maybe even grew up with their parents talking about FDR. And is that this is an important thing about leadership, and you should understand it. Leadership is based on many things, but it's often based on experience. And Gary Wills, in an article writing about Stevenson and FDR, he says, the difference between FDR and Stevenson is the polio. You all know FDR had polio. Both gentlemen were kind of mama's boys, kind of pampered, dilettantes. I mean, is it born with a silver spoon, kind of thinking they were on second or third base and thought they hit a double or triple, but it's actually they were born there. That was their pedigree, okay? So why did FDR emerge into such a marvelous leader and Adlai Stevenson did not? And people say it's the polio, because the world was FDR's oyster and he got polio. His life was, his ambitions are end. He sent down to Warm Springs to recover with all these other polio victims. And he could have, and he did for a while, sink in the depths of depression. And then he decided part of his role, and I use that term depression advisedly here, decided his role was he was going to cheer up the other people at Warm Springs. And so he became the cheerful voice and the voice of optimism and hope. And there we will recover. There will be life beyond our malady here. Now ratchet forward. He gets elected president in 1932. The country is in the depths of depression. And what did he do? He told us there was hope. He told the country there was hope. There will be some light at the end of the tunnel. We will overcome this. And is it basically what happened is he, despite his legs being absolutely worthless and not helpful to him, this guy had a spine that would absolutely astound you and was able to take us through the Depression. And see, that's the difference. Leadership often gets tested by experience. But even someone like, and this is why I tell you how fragile freedom is, like FDR is prone to compromising on freedom. FDR was sworn in on March 4th, 1933. They used to do it in March. They changed it to January in the 1941. In his inaugural speech, you can look it up, he addressed the veterans from the World War I. They just called it the World War then, and said, You took an oath when you joined and fought in the army. You are still under that oath, and you are bound by that oath to me as your commander-in-chief. He was telling them that if I say something, you have to follow it. The New York Herald Tribune that day had a headline, "It's Time for a Dictatorship." Walter Lippmann, one of the most prominent reporters, said, "Franklin, it's time for you to assume dictatorial powers." That's when Al Smith said, "We got to do what we did in the World War. We wrapped the Constitution in a piece of paper and put it on the shelf." Many people were calling for extraordinary powers in the suspension of liberties. And do you know who they cited as the model for why they should do this? It was a gentleman who was ruling a European country, a gentleman who made the trains run on time. That gentleman's name was Benito Mussolini. Think about that. Think about that time in our history. You can go to the Library of Commerce and you can see the speech that FDR was going to give the day after he was sworn in, telling the country he was going to be assuming dictatorial powers. He didn't give the speech, and we are so much the lucky for that. But that is an illustration how fragile our freedoms are. And I think he understood that the American people wouldn't stand for it. As bad as the Depression was and as bad as the talk was that our form of democracy could not deal with the problems we face, he understood that the people would not give up their freedoms. Another example of bad behavior in our country. Anybody here who's got German ancestry, raise your hand. Oh, a lot of Germans here in Minnesota. You know, are you familiar with Executive Order 9066? Well, that was an executive order that said that first-generation speakers of Japanese, Italian, and German should be interred. FDR signed that order. I mean, is that there's a teacher in a Hopkins High School, he says, and you know, I am a product of that executive order. My father was from Cincinnati, my mother was from Long Island. They were German speakers, they were interred in southern Texas, that's where they met, and they weren't released until 2 years after the war ended. Now, we don't have too much of that history in Minnesota, and I'm proud of that, is that we have some. But we had a governor back then who was actually the founder of my law firm, and there's going to be a symposium down here next Friday about him. His name is Harold Stassen. And Harold Stassen essentially went out to Washington, D.C. and said, "Mr. President, not in my state, you're not going to." About 30% of the people of our state were German. Now think about it. Is it we're coming out of a period of 9/11. You know, how do we want to treat and react to people? The Internment Act in the World War is one of the blights on our history. But again, it illustrates to you how fragile freedom is. And that's why we need to keep balance in our government. You don't want an executive too strong. You want a vibrant legislative. I'll give you a history. Do we have revolutions in our country? We surely know about the American Revolution. We know of the War of Southern Rebellion, which is a civil war. But we have the potential for rebellion or revolution in our country every 2 years. Do you know when the last revolution was? It was 2 years ago. The power of Congress tipped. The power of Congress shifted. It shouldn't have, given all the dynamics of that election and who was up and who was going to run in the Senate, whatever. It shouldn't have flipped. 2008 was a good year that it looked like it might flip, but it wasn't going to happen in 2006. But the people decided that things were out of balance. And so there's a lot of frustration in Congress right now, as Congress is not getting a lot of things done. But you need to understand, again, the magnificence of this document and the design is that what happens is that there's other powers to Congress, and one of those is oversight powers. And I'll give you an example. Early 1940s, you have this pipsqueak senator out of Missouri. He's a failed hat salesman. He's a crony of the Pendergast machine, and he gets elected to the Senate in the 30s, and he moves up to a position on the Senate Armed Services Committee. FDR's pet program is the Lend-Lease program, where he's sending all these military supplies to England. But there's fraud in that program. system. This pipsqueak senator, exercising the power of authority of the Congress, oversight, says, Mr. President, you got about $18 billion of fraud here. Back in 1940s, $18 billion was a big amount. Now, that senator was Harry Truman. Now, Harry Truman says, you know, he probably was chosen to be vice president because the businesses wanted him out of the Senate. But in any case, this is somebody who was exercising those powers that Congress has in a part of the design in our system. And you should understand how important that basically is. And I can cite any number of other people who have stood up. Luther Youngdahl, former governor, district court judge, stood up to the McCarthy abuses of the McCarthy era in the early 50s. And we have other people standing up. But I want to leave you with this message here is that your freedom is what provides you with the opportunity in this country. And it's fragile. It's dynamic. And the preservation of freedom is not something that is a race that's already been won. It is a marathon that's going to go on through all your life, and you need to show up, and you need to preserve it. And I'm going to digress here a little bit. How many of you watch Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, Tina Fey, and whatever? Is that, you know, and maybe some of the people are lamenting that you get too much of your information from those sources. I want to tell you is that you shouldn't get it all from them. But I'm fans of those people. You know, the Foreign Policy magazine did a survey of the top 25 intellectual leaders in the world right now. Stephen Colbert got the most write-in votes. He must have mentioned it on his show or something. But anyway, is that what you need to understand is the role of the funny man in a democracy. And the best example is to go back to the late 19th century. Matthew Arnold, the poet, social critic from England, came over and said, you know, there's some things that are really fundamentally wrong in the United States. One of the things is that they don't show enough respect to the upper class. And then he went on to lament the role of the funny man. And he was pointing his finger right at Mark Twain. You know, Mark Twain was writing as that the United States of Lynchville and some of these other social critic things. And he was talking about it. Mark Twain was hurt and wounded by those comments. He wrote a response to it, never published it, but is found. And here's what he said. And you need to remember this. A discriminating irreverence is the creator and protector of human liberty. Two key words, a discriminating irreverence. There is the role for the funny man in a democracy. Now, Ray was laughing. He wasn't being a funny man. But, you know, is it if he left here and I wasn't called out, he could probably have written a satirical attitude or article about this arrogant person who came in. And he probably would, you know, write it satirically and humorously, but he would make the point and point out is that the errors are my way. And so as you understand is that in a democracy, you need all of these healthy civic sites, whether it be government, school, colleges, home, family, churches, they all need to be strong and vibrant. And it's all right if in some of those sites you have a discriminating irreverence, because that's what keeps us humble. And that's what keeps those who you give sovereign power in line. Now, I'm going to end on just a couple of thoughts. Is that I have my mentee from St. Thomas Law School with me today. And is that some of the sites, and some of the ways that you can guarantee and preserve your freedom is to older people, younger people, mentor. Educate other people about the role and what the important role of freedoms are. And there's one thing that's interesting about a mentor. I had some great mentors, some great teachers, and I still think of myself reaching my hand upward and grabbing that hand and having them pull me along and inspiring me and pushing me along. The other thing, though, as I remember, is at the same time I can have my hand reaching back and I can grab the hand of somebody else and I can mentor them. Lindsay who introduced me. She's thinking of going to law school. I mean, just like that, I said, you've got to come up to the court, you've got to visit me. That's my obligation. That's what you do in a society. You reach back. At the same time, I'm reaching forward. The other thing is, don't be afraid to have heroes. You know, heroes can disappoint you. They can have clay feet. But they can inspire you in giving you vision. And so I believe in heroes. I have a lot of heroes in my life, and some have disappointed me. But I tell you, they've been very helpful to me. And then finally, I'm going to tell you, is that, you know, I got a great job. I wish I had a little more time to tell you, but just think about it. I get to deal with current everyday issues. I get to interpret the Constitution. I get to discuss those with superb colleagues. I get to listen to good lawyers presenting it. I write opinions, and actually they have the force of law. Wow. Is it getting better than that? I mean, it's awesome. It's awesome. And so oftentimes students will say to me, Justice Anderson, I agree with you. You got a great job. How do you get that great job? And then I generally quote Woody Allen. And I'll do that because I get your attention when I say Woody Allen. But Woody Allen said, the world is run by those who show up. We are truly a land of opportunity. I told you about my experience from China, and is that our advantage is the opportunities that provide us with the opportunity to think outside of the envelope. Your job, and I'm thinking about what I was, my mindset and what I was 40 years ago sitting in a class. I had no idea what I was going to do. I can tell you, I know something about this crowd here today. I can tell you something predictable and unpredictable. The predictable part is future leaders of this state and this country are right here in this room. I know that. I know that because Carleton's history and the education you get. What's unpredictable is which one of you or which ones are going to be those leaders. Because it was surely unpredictable when I was sitting in convocation in McAllister that I'd be doing what I was doing. But it is absolutely predictable. You will be leaders. And in order to get to that position, that role, your obligation is to look for opportunities and show up. And see what happens when you show up. And I don't have time to tell you the things I showed up for. You gain experience. Most times it's good. Sometimes it's bad. But in any case, you have an experience that teaches you lessons. And from those lessons, you get insights into yourself. You get insights into the world. You gain confidence. You gain understanding. You take some of the blinders off. You see other opportunities, and you show up, and you repeat that cycle. And the marvelous thing about this cycle is it's not a cycle. It's an upward expanding spiral, because you keep showing up, and it expands, and it keeps wider and wider. You keep showing up. Experience, lessons, insights, show up for opportunities. And a kid who was sitting at McAllister College who grew up milking cows really wondered what his future was, wondered whether he belonged, by having opportunities and showing up to him, could wind up on the Minnesota Supreme Court and doing what I'm doing. See, that's the way it works. So that's your obligation. And so finally, I'm going to leave you with one other message here, and then I'll quit and answer some questions. Is that, what am I about today? Why did I talk about history? Why did I try to give you a civics lesson? Nobody said it better than Thomas Jefferson. And he said this, I know no safe depository for the ultimate powers of society but the people themselves. And if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it away from them, but to inform their discretion by education. I hope today that I have informed you, the safe depository of our liberty, the place where the ultimate powers of our society rest, that your discretion is somewhat informed today by a bit of education. Thank you very much. Now, I love questions. I know some of you got places to go. I'm not offended by that, but I will be offended if nobody asks a question. And is that you got to put me on the spot.
If you raise your hand, I'll bring a microphone to you for your question.
Okay, we got a couple questions here.
Hi. You were talking about the give and take of power between the different branches of government and how it kind of ebbs and flows between the executive, judiciary, legislative, but that the system is fairly durable over the long run.
Fragile, but it has been durable.
So is it possible for one branch to seize so much power that it causes some kind of irreparable damage to the system? And how would you know that that was happening?
So far, based on my study of history, we haven't had any irreparable damage. But I will tell you something. I was born in the mid-1940s. I'm just a year or two ahead of the baby boom. When I was growing up, we had the threat of nuclear war, the Soviet, the evil empire. I mean, I was one of those kids that was told to hide under my desk in order to protect myself from nuclear holocaust, and is that I was there when the Cuban Missile Crisis, and my sister came up to me and said, "Are we all going to die?" Those are real threats. I will tell you that in recent years, I have never been more concerned about the future of our country right now than I have been about the balance of power. And the idea, I said, and I'm really concerned about the concentration of power in the executive, okay? Some people talk about judicial activism. No, it's a judicial activism. That's an epithet. Kind of really labels this at what you, you just don't agree with the opinion. Is that the danger in our society is the excessive concentration of power in one branch or the other, or one branch becomes too benign. And we have had those periods of time. And I mean, you take a look at the 1930s. I mean, you had a very powerful executive, a very compliant legislature. You had a Supreme Court that resisted FDR. And is that there you had the switch in time to save nine in 1937. You know, I'm a little more sympathetic to the Supreme Court back then because they were actually worried about the balance of power getting out of whack. They feared that FDR would become a Mussolini or a Hitler. Is that it didn't. We got close. I think we've gotten a little too close than I thought we should after 9/11. Oh, let me give you a quote. This is when you have to be the most vigilant. Is that, I find it here, where did I put it? Is that basically the quote will say is that it's time of national crisis when you have to be most wary about the loss of your fundamental freedoms. It's not in the times of good times or the time of peaces where you really worry about your freedoms. Ah, here it is. I just got to find my right source. Is that, where is it? Yeah, I got two quotes for Henry Steele Commager. Freedom is not a luxury that we can indulge in when at last we have security and prosperity and enlightenment. It is rather antecedent to all of these, for without freedom, we can have neither security nor prosperity or enlightenment. Or if you want me to bring it a little closer to home, a quote from former Governor Luther Youngdahl when he was dealing with the Owen Latimer case in the McCarthy era. He says, "When public excitement runs high as to alien ideologies." Whew, that could be kind of contemporary, couldn't it be? "When public excitement runs high as to alien ideologies, it's a time when we must be particularly alert not to impair the ancient landmarks set up in the Bill of Rights." We have come close. We recently have come a whole lot closer than I'm comfortable with, but I have an unfettered faith in the people of this country that they know how to get it right. And you'll correct it. Sometimes it takes you a little while to get it, but you understand freedom, and that's part of my role is to be out here and talk to you, and hopefully is that to make you aware of it's you. It's your role. Nobody else is going to protect it unless you do it. And so, we come close, but the people have always righted the ship, restored the balance, reinvented ourselves as a country, and we've gone forward. And so I'm confident we'll do the same thing, but I've got to tell you, you got to work hard to get there. Okay. Another question. Oh, there's one back there, a couple back there.
Hi. During your time in the courts, what do you feel was your most important decision to turn back a threat against the Constitution?
Okay. I'll tell you, I'll tell you where I came the closest to the edge of the Constitution is that and that's with the sexually dangerous persons. Under the law, we confine people to institutions civilly on the basis that they could be a threat to society. Now, think about this. Somebody has committed a crime. It's a sex crime. And the law says you will pay this penalty. You will serve so many years in prison. You will once you serve those terms in prison, the state says, we don't want you in society. So we are going to continue to confine you. And we're going to confine you because you cannot control your impulses with respect to sexual behavior. Now, you understand, is the origins of this law is a very benevolent law. Originated in the 1930s at the time of psychoanalysis and the understanding that mental illness is an illness and it can be treated. But some people are so ill that they will not submit themselves to treatment, so the state has the ability to enter an order and take their freedom away and treat them. This evolves and evolves and evolves, so now we make the determination that if somebody cannot control their sexual impulses, they will be confined. We have something like 500 people confined under this civil law in the state of Minnesota. None of those, I don't think any of those who have been confined have been released. And the presumption is we are treating them and that they can be cured. And I remember when that case was before us, I asked the attorney, I said, what is the difference of what we're doing than what the Russians did with the Medved brothers? If you understand the Medved brothers, is that they were confined to the closed city of Gorky on the basis that they were mentally ill because they opposed the Soviet government in power. I mean, if we have this type of power to confine civilly mentally ill and we define mental illness, where does it end? And is that the state came back in one case, is that if you're mentally ill and dangerous and confined, is that the law provides you with a six-month review as to your status. State came back and said, that doesn't apply to the sexually dangerous person. And they were very uncomfortable when I said, but wait a second, you sold this to us on the basis that there would be treatment. Why shouldn't they be entitled to the same type of review? Well, we do allow that confinement. I signed off on one of those opinions, as close to the edge of the Constitution as I ever want to come. And it's dicey. We do have some other cases where basically the United States Supreme Court, and it ebbs and flows, it's narrowing its view with respect to individual rights and search and seizure. And that's another marvelous thing about our country. We have a dual federalism system. We have a state constitution. And there have been some cases, State versus Flowers, State versus Ashcroft, not State versus Jackson. I did that under the United States Constitution where I said, you know, history and tradition in Minnesota is that we have more liberty and we will define it under the Minnesota Constitution. I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to go on too long. I'm sitting at a conference out in Washington, D.C., and a federal judge, and Frank Easterbrook, he's now chief judge of the Seventh Circuit. I know from a friend that said he would be Scalia's favorite to replace him on the Supreme Court. But some of the state justices were saying, the United States Supreme Court is changing its jurisprudence, and it's narrowing civil liberties. What do we do as states when we don't necessarily agree with that, and we have decades of law that goes in the different direction? Easterbrook was telling the justice, well, live with it. It's the United States Supreme Court, after all. So me being me, I don't know how I did it, but I did it. But I raised my hand, and I said, I introduced myself. I'm Justice Paul Anderson. I'm from Minnesota. You know where we are. You fly over us when you go to the coast, right up there next to Canada. Some of you think we're Canadians. We aren't, almost, but we aren't. And I'll tell you and explain how we see the law. And I'll tell you in the terms of the story of Elmer and Ethel. Elmer and Ethel are this farm couple in west central Minnesota. They, in the 70s, they turned the farm over to the boys. They still own the land, and Saturday afternoon they're driving into town. They're going to go to church, which probably means they're Catholic. They're going to go do some shopping, and they stop at the Chatterbox Cafe. Actually, I said that. And I was thinking of Olivia and my in-laws, and there is a Chatterbox Cafe in Olivia. And they're driving down the road, and they see this Miata coming the other way. Young couple in the Miata. And despite the bucket seats and the stick shift in the middle, they are so close together, you couldn't get a blade of straw between them. Of course, Elmer's behind the wheel. Ethel's over next to the door in a pickup, and Ethel looks at Elmer and says, "You know, Elmer, we used to be that way." Elmer says, "Well, you know, Ethel, I'm still sitting where I used to sit." And I said, "Mr. Easterbrook, that's the way we see it in Minnesota. If the Supreme Court is moved over by the passenger door, and we want to stay sitting where we used to sit, we will sometimes go to our state constitution to stay there." And so those are some of the constitutional issues that I've had to grapple with. We don't do it very often. We don't do it cavalierly. We really do put a premium on harmony with the U.S. Constitution, but that option is there. Another question. I see.
Actually, we've run out of time, so I'm sorry to have to cut it off, but we have concluded our time.
If you've got questions, come on up. Do I have a couple of minutes if they come down and want to ask? Come on down and ask questions. I love questions and want to provide your answers. As I said, I want you to be informed citizens. Thank you much.